From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. 545 migrant children are still waiting to be reunited with their parents more than 3 years after they were separated at the southern border. That's according to a new court document filed yesterday by lawyers from the ACLU. Nonprofits and court-appointed lawyers who've been searching for parents after federal rulings in 2018 and 2019 now say they haven't been able to find many of these families because they've already been deported to countries like Honduras, Mexico, and Guatemala. And in some cases, reunification may not be possible. For more on this, we're joined by KQED reporter Michelle Wiley, who's been following efforts to get these families back together. Michelle, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And I just want to take a moment to be clear. 545 children do not live with their families as a direct result of the Trump administration's zero tolerance policy that actively separated parents from their children starting in 2018, and that actually the children we're hearing about today predate the official policy. Why is that?
That's right. So these children are, these families really are part of the group who were separated as part of a pilot program in El Paso, which there was a report from the Inspector General of the Department of Health and Human Services who found that in these separations go back to as early as July 2017. So this predates what we think of as the so-called zero tolerance policy that really came into effect in the spring of 2018. This predates that by several months.
Well, the ACLU's filing yesterday in this ongoing court case reminds us of something that you actually already knew, that these families were out there and that reunifying them has been an incredibly difficult process. Why has it been so hard?
Right. So part of the difficulty is that when these separations happened, the government officials didn't keep good track of where families went. And a lot of the contact information they have for them is several years old. You know, I think about how much your life might change in 3 years. You might move, you might change your phone number. This information is all pretty outdated. And in some cases, it was incomplete or just, wrong. So folks who are looking for these parents to try and reunify them with their children, they're trying to overcome that hurdle and find folks who, frankly, have had a really negative experience with the U.S. government and maybe are afraid of being found.
Right, mistrustful of anyone who comes to their door. And in fact, there's a group called Justice in Motion that is actually going door to door in Central American cities and towns trying to find these families with the limited information that they have. How do they even begin to do that, and what's the process look like?
So as part of a court case in October, November of 2019, the government provided the ACLU, Justice in Motion, they're part of a steering committee whose job it is to work on these reunifications. They provided them with lists of names and contact information for families. So what the steering committee does, the first step is that they try and call people, they try and get a hold of them through any means that they have. And for those folks who they can't reach by phone, can't reach by email, the next step they have is to try and find them on the ground. So that means, going from town to town in places like Honduras, Guatemala, and looking for people and or their family members, trying to figure out where someone is to let them know that they might have options for being reunified with their children. So that's kind of the process that they go through.
It was already a tough process, but then the pandemic hit, which limited movement for a lot of people. How does that affect things?
Right. So in March, when the pandemic sort of was becoming news for all of us, the search was basically completely shut down, not only to protect the health of the people who are called defenders who go from town to town searching for folks, but to protect the health of the communities that they would be going into to make sure that the virus wasn't spreading. So, as of August, some of these searches have been able to restart, but it's on a much more limited basis to make sure that they're following health protocols. So, for example, there are only certain days where folks can leave their house. We spoke to a defender whose name's Dora Malara, who said that, she has certain days where she can leave, but it's very restrictive. So she can't stay overnight in a place that's not her home. And that really limits the amount that she can travel and how far she can go.
And just very briefly, many of these children have spent the last 3 years without any contact with their parents, unfathomable to anyone who has children. Is there a chance that, you know, these families will never be reunited?
You know, if you speak to advocates and folks on the steering committee, they say they're going to keep searching as long as it takes to find all these parents and find these kids. But I think the process is really opaque right now. We don't know where folks are. We don't know how long it will take. And every day that we wait, all this harm is being done to parents and their children.
Right. That's KQED's Michelle Wiley. Thank you for your reporting. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, let's go to Wisconsin now, where Governor Tony Evers has begged residents to abide by coronavirus restrictions and warned that the state's economy is going to tank if they don't. COVID-19 has come roaring back in the state after it was tamped down in April and March, with record highs in hospitalizations and critical care. And things are expected to get worse because more people are testing positive, maybe heading to hospitals. And yesterday, Wisconsin's top health official warned that people should scrap any Thanksgiving gatherings. Too dangerous. Dr. Nasia Safdar is the medical director of infection control at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Hospital. And doctor, according to the Dartmouth University Atlas Project, which tracks new cases per capita, 4 of the top 10 COVID-19 hotspots are in your state: Neenah, Appleton, Green Bay, and Wausau.
We're in pretty dire straits, I would say, as a state. This is the first time that Wisconsin has really had to grapple with the pandemic in its full intensity. And I think it just shows you how quickly and how rampant it can get, and us feeling rather, you know, helpless in the face of it all.
Well, just quickly, what happened? Because we're reading that there were outbreaks in September when students, you know, came back to the University of Wisconsin system. But students are now being credited by health officials with tamping that down. They've put on masks. They're social distancing. So is this surge now stemming from that, or is something else going on? What's going on?
You know, I think it's hard to pinpoint it to one inciting event. And I think most other states have also seen that there isn't typically one event. The virus has been circulating somewhat silently within the population, and eventually it reaches a tipping point, and then it becomes very apparent that things are not going in the right direction. The way that it was tamped down in the student population, I think, is exactly what you would like to see, that, yes, you have a little bit of a surge, but then after that, you're able to get it under control. I think the concern now with Wisconsin is that not only are we going in the wrong direction, we also don't seem to have any kind of great mitigation measures that would really tamp this down, because it's become so widespread.
Well, it's also become a political football. Last week, a judge in your state temporarily put a hold on your governor's order limiting capacity at bars and restaurants to 25%. Many states just closed everything, but he just wanted to limit it until at least November 6th. So that was thwarted. But then this week, a Wisconsin judge reinstated the order. So it's a little late, but you can now limit people in bars. But the state Supreme Court struck down Evers' initial stay-at-home order earlier this year. And Republicans there are challenging the statewide mask mandate. And you have President Trump holding a rally in Janesville on Saturday, you know, saying we're rounding the corner and mocking masks and too much talk about COVID-19. I mean, how much is the effort to stop this there thwarted by politics?
You know, I think we don't have to imagine this. We've seen it. We've seen it with other infectious conditions, that anytime an epidemic of any kind is led by science, it has a better chance of being successfully contained than the times when it is not. Public health measures are not something that there's a great deal of debate about at this point, this far into the pandemic. And I think not only does it take a lot of energy then to continue fighting the things that you know you must do, but also it's an opportunity cost. You know, every moment that you spend arguing about what you should be doing, you're not spending that time actually enforcing and implementing it.
Well, meantime, I know you built a field hospital there. Has it been used yet? And this is for beds when hospitals run out of beds.
It's been activated. I think it's open for admissions at this point. Our health system is not yet at the point where we have needed to have patients be transferred there, but it is a very welcome option, because they may welcome a time when we will need to use it in its full capacity.
Yeah, it's just outside Milwaukee. Meantime, what is it? Can you describe? We haven't heard in a while since the, you know, huge outbreaks in New York and maybe Florida. I feel we're not really hearing what's going on in hospitals.
I think in general, there's a fair amount of stress and fatigue. People have been dealing with this now for many months. And, you know, in one respect, this is a really bad time for this to have happened in Wisconsin, because we know that flu season is around the corner and people are quite burnt out and stressed, I think, everywhere in the state and in other states where they've had COVID. Having said that, I mean, healthcare workers have enormous reserves of resilience, but it would be nice if the trajectory in Wisconsin could be suppressed.
Yeah, it would be nice. Dr. Nasia Safdar, Medical Director of Infection Control at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Hospital, as that state sees a huge surge in COVID-19. Doctor, best of luck to you there.
Thank you.
It's coming down to the wire in the presidential race.
Here's President Trump campaigning in Erie, Pennsylvania last night.
Before the plague came in, I had it made. I wasn't coming to Erie. I mean, I have to be honest. There's no way I was coming. I didn't have to. I would have called you and said, hey, Erie, you know, if you have a chance, get out. But we had this thing won. We were so
And Joe Biden is off the trail, but he did give an interview to Milwaukee TV station WISN. He was asked whether there's any legitimacy to unverified emails that purport to show he and his son Hunter profited off the Biden name in Ukraine when Biden was vice president.
None whatsoever. This is the same garbage Rudy Giuliani, Trump's henchman. It's a last-ditch effort in this desperate campaign to smear me and my family.
But will it come up in tomorrow's final debate, and how should the candidates handle it? Let's bring in our political strategist, Alice Stewart, the Republican. Hi, Alice.
Hi, Robin. Great to join you.
And Bill Press, the Democrat. Hi to you as well.
Hello, hello.
And I want to ask just how you think the candidates are doing. I'm going to start with you, Alice. President Trump has been gutting Dr. Fauci and Leslie Stahl of 60 Minutes, leading locker-up chants about Michigan's Governor Whitmer, who was targeted by white militiamen who on tape are saying the same things the president is now saying at rallies. You know, we don't want to be in a lockdown. You know, Republican pollster Frank Luntz says the Trump team is running the worst campaign he's ever seen. They should be sued for political malpractice. Do you agree?
I think Frank is certainly very outspoken on this, but Robin, it's pretty obvious. We have 13 days until Election Day, and this should be about the needs of the American people, not about the personal grievances of the American president. And what they need to do, the Trump campaign, every day moving forward, is talk about COVID. And what they can do to certainly reassure Americans that they're working on a vaccine and what they can do to be safe, and ask the question that is foremost on Americans' minds, are you better off today than you were 4 years ago? And a new Gallup poll shows that 56% of Americans say yes, they are better off. And that's a message the president needs to drive home.
I'm going to stay with you 1 second. Bill, you're going to jump in a second. But Trump is also signaling that he's going to bring up Hunter Biden. We just mentioned those unsubstantiated emails provided by Rudy Giuliani. Again, Frank Luntz says nobody cares about Hunter Biden. This is to what you're saying, that the president is off message. On Fox this morning, former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee agreed. Should Trump, Alice, do you think President Trump should bring it up?
Whether he should or should not, he will. And the reality is this is not about Hunter Biden. This is about the question of whether or not Joe Biden profited off of foreign money, off of Ukraine, off of communist China. And the questions should be answered. But in the next 13 days, that's not what American people care about. They are concerned about their own personal needs and not about Hunter Biden and whether or not Joe Biden worked together to receive money, which raises question about his whether or not he will be influenced if he were to be president. But I don't see that as an issue the president needs to continue to bring up.
Okay, Bill, well, we're going to bring you in now to talk about this. What do you think Joe Biden should do? Because Alice is clear. The president has been clear. He's going to bring it up, and there's going to be a debate on Thursday, and Joe Biden is going to have to come up with something to say.
There are 3 points there you discussed with Alice. Let me just comment briefly on each one. Number one, Hunter Biden. I love when they talk about Hunter Biden. This has been investigated by the media. It's been investigated by Republicans in the Senate. As Gertrude Stein said of Oakland, California, there is no there there. And every minute that Donald Trump spends talking about Hunter Biden is a minute he is not talking about the issues that Americans care about. So the more he talks about Hunter Biden, I think the better it is for Joe Biden. Secondly, in terms of Donald Trump's message, I agree with Alice. He should be talking about COVID. He should get off the personality kick. I would point out that the Hill newspaper today quotes Senator John Cornyn and Senator John Thune, the second-ranking Republican in the Senate, saying the president should stop get off his personality attacks and start talking about policies. Will he? I doubt it, but that's what he should be doing. And thirdly, I agree with Alice that Joe Biden should also be talking about COVID, COVID, COVID. That's what he's been talking about from the beginning. He has made this election, tried to make it a referendum on coronavirus. I think that has been his message. He should continue that message from now until November 3rd. And I think the message is just this simple. 8.3 million Americans have contracted the disease under Donald Trump's lack of leadership. 220,000 are dead. We're told the worst is yet to come. I just heard your story on what's happening in Wisconsin. 36 states are reporting increased cases. And so Joe Biden should say, who do you trust to get us out of this mess? The guy who screwed it up, or do you trust me? I think that's the message, and it's a winning message.
But Bill, the fact is, Joe Biden is not making that message right now. He's not on the campaign trail. He's preparing for this debate on Thursday, and you could ask whether or not that debate is even going to be consequential in the final days of this election. Why isn't he out there right now putting that message out?
Well, first of all, he has been putting that message out, Peter. Kamala Harris is putting that message out. Other people are, that is the message of the Biden campaign, right? I do not know, honestly do not know what the message of the Trump campaign is. That is the message of the Biden campaign. As far as tonight, you bet he will hammer home that message in the debate. You know, this debate is interesting tonight, or tomorrow night, right? Normally, the debate would favor the incumbent. I think this debate favors the challenger, because all Joe Biden has to do is not make a serious mistake or gaffe, and he'll be fine. Donald Trump, with only 12 days tomorrow to go, has to find a way to turn the momentum of this election around, which means he's going to have to be on his best behavior, and he's going to have to talk about the serious issues, not Hunter Biden. And frankly, I wouldn't put money on the fact that he'll be able to contain himself.
Well, but Alice, I do want to ask you about that, because you say COVID, COVID, COVID. And that, you know, how does he talk about COVID when he's dismissing it? And it's saying it's disappearing, when we know in just about every state it's increasing. We're heading into this surge in the winter months. I mean, doesn't he have to be reschooled on how he talks about COVID-19?
I think it's important not just to talk the talk, but walk the walk on COVID. And moving forward, it's important to make sure and reinforce the guidelines and the requests that are being made by our public health officials with regard to wearing masks and social distancing.
Hold on. I'm sorry, because I really want to hear this from you. He does the exact opposite. He says it's going away. Yeah, yeah. Go ahead.
That's my point. He needs to change the topic of conversation and what he is saying with regard to making sure that his actions match the words that the public health officials are giving, and reinforce to the American people what he is doing to find a virus. And he needs to get this off a referendum on him and make the case for, this is not a referendum on President Trump. This is a binary choice between the Trump policies and Biden policies, which are limited government, law and order, fiscal responsibility, and making sure that Americans can put food on the table. And that is a stark contrast to Joe Biden.
Well, but Bill, hold on, because I know you.
Yes. Okay.
I want to give you something to chew on too, because, you know, as Alice just acknowledged, I mean, I don't know that he can do this, but also he seems to be appealing to people who don't want him to. I want you to listen to something, because our friends at WBUR spoke with two Republicans in New Hampshire, one hotelier Dan Innes and teacher Leah Walchko. And they were asked about what is thought of as Trump's failure with COVID-19. They don't see it that way. They like what they're seeing. They want to get out, as he says. Let's listen.
You know, he came down with COVID. The guy got through it just fine, and he's back on the campaign trail. If that isn't a message of strength and hope, I don't know what is.
My mother-in-law is in one of those nursing homes. No more seeing the grandchild for Nana. Is my mother-in-law never going to leave her solitary confinement? What's the reason to be alive?
Bill, how do Democrats respond to that? Trump is saying what they want to hear.
Democrats respond by telling the truth. The truth is we are not turning the corner on the coronavirus. All the evidence is out there. Robin, you've been talking about it, Peter, you've been reporting it. Again, 8.3 million Americans with the disease, 220,000 dead, right? Yes, there are some people who believe Donald Trump. They are wrong, and he is wrong. And he's out there saying, we're turning the corner, and he's out there calling Tony Fauci, Anthony Fauci, a disaster. Now, how does that get the truth out?
Robin, is part of getting through COVID is opening up schools and businesses safely, and that's the president's priority.
Just quickly, we have a minute left here. Alice, this reminds me of what you said at the top of this segment. There was a Gallup poll that, you know, 56% of Americans think they're better off 4 years ago. I've spoken with those Trump supporters as well. But what they don't say is, how is the rest of the country doing? And, you know, the coronavirus is one example, the racial strife that's going on. I mean, there's so many other things going on that I don't think that President Trump is adequately addressing.
Well, certainly, Peter, obviously no one wants to have to deal with coronavirus and the circumstances with regard to that. But you cannot blame all of that on President Trump. And the bottom line is, when you have 56%, more than half of Americans feel as if they're better off, that is a good place for any president to be. And it's certainly something he can tout.
Peter, Ronald Reagan said, it happened on my watch, and this has happened on Donald Trump's watch, and he...
Okay,
we gotta leave
Bill
it there.
Press.
Bill Press,
yeah, Bill
the
Press
Democrat,
the Democrat,
Alice Stewart, our Republican. Thanks so much to you both.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT's System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT's School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a master's in engineering and management. STM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology, with over 20 years of on-campus, hybrid, and distance education experience. Join a virtual info session on Wednesday, October 21st from 7 to 8 p.m. stm.mit.edu.
More Americans are slowly returning to the skies, even as the coronavirus surges across the country. And that's renewed fears about how air travel might spread the virus. Well, this week, the number of U.S. air travels in a single day surpassed 1 million for the first time since March. That steady rise coming as airlines continue to stare down deficits in the absence of that new relief from Congress. So again, is this safe? Let's bring in Seth Kaplan, transportation analyst for Here and Now. And Seth, start with this, you know, overall demand, because we know it's less than half of what it typically is for this time of year. But the pandemic seems to be having less of an impact. So, you know, is it just that we're going into the fall and people are tired? I mean, what's behind the uptick in travel?
You're right, Robin. For the first time, really, since the pandemic started, we've kind of seen demand and pandemic news sometimes going in different directions. As you mentioned, look, demand's still way less than we would ever expect in a normal environment. But up until recently, when there was particularly bad pandemic news, people would get scared and stop flying. When the news was a bit better, maybe demand would recover a little bit. And here, we're kind of in the middle of a surge here for the past several weeks, and yet demand, at least modestly, going in the right direction. So it kind of seems like a certain number of Americans are just comfortable traveling again at this point, albeit a rather small number compared to usual. And maybe this is just how it's going to be until there's a vaccine.
Well, I kind of did a tease there, and I want to, you know, use some of this information that NPR is also reporting on. This study from Hong Kong, where they test and track everybody who lands in the city. You get tested, and then you get quarantined in single rooms for 14 days, and then they get tested again. Huge testing that's being studied by doctors at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. And they're finding that if people wear masks and are socially distanced on airplanes, and you will be, you won't, you know, there's seats they're not selling, and airlines are saying you must wear your mask, and in some cases people are double masking and wearing those big plastic screens, there's very little transmission. I mean, it's wonderful. It's just one study, but it's wonderful evidence that, in fact, you know, masks combined with, you've told us, airlines recycle air, so they're getting rid of some of the infected air. that even when people are infected and get on airplanes, the transmission is low to nothing.
Right, and airlines point out that the air flows down on airplanes rather than sideways as it does in some other rooms. You're right. There's disagreement in the scientific community about the details, about precisely how rare transmission is, and not a ton of peer-reviewed science yet. But there is fairly widespread acceptance of the idea that if everybody's wearing a mask, the risk of transmission on an airplane is quite low. Look, a few airlines are still blocking middle seats. Some are not. But not a lot of evidence that if everybody's doing what they should be doing, that there's a lot of transmission on airplanes. The fear still seems to be more about everything else, what's going to happen at your destination.
Right, or walking through the airport, or, you know, you have to wipe your seat down too. I mean, there's all other factors, as you said. But meanwhile, how is the airline industry doing? I mean, what is the sense of whether or not they'll get the help they need?
Well, they haven't yet, and if anything here, sort of the political imperative, the longer they stay alive without that second tranche of aid, you know, hard to say anybody's acting more urgently now than they were right before the last deadline, October 1st.
Yeah. Here now, transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. We'll keep touching base with you as the holiday season comes. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
The outcome of the 2020 presidential election could help decide the future of one of America's most infamous prisons. After 9/11, the U.S. government sent hundreds of suspected terrorists to the Guantanamo Bay prison in Cuba, and it's been mired in controversy ever since. President Obama promised to close it, but couldn't follow through, while President Trump promised to keep it open and fill it up with bad dudes. Missy Ryan covers the Pentagon and national security for The Washington Post, and she joins us now via Skype. Missy, welcome.
Thank you.
And we want to get to what the candidates' plans for the prison would be in just a moment. But first, I think it's worth reminding people why it's there in the first place. What was the prison's role in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks and the wars that followed?
Yeah, well, the Guantanamo Bay prison really took center stage after the 9/11 attacks. And the United States took a number of more than 700 prisoners originally in the first few years. Prisoners mostly captured in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and then prisoners from all over the world to be subject to detention. And then some of them were subject to military commissions, which were supposed to be special judicial processes set up for prisoners of war, essentially.
All right. Well, the Bush administration tried to send away hundreds of them, even though it was the Bush administration that opened the prison. The Obama administration also sent a few hundred more away. And there's just 40 people left. Is that right?
That's right. There's 40 individuals, about almost 10 of whom are subject to part of a military commission process, meaning there's an ongoing case. Most of them are not in a trial, but there are a few who are. And then the remainder are what people who follow Guantanamo call forever detainees, potentially whose fates are less clear. They're not expected to be subject to a military commission trial, partly because of problems with evidence and the idea that they couldn't undergo a successful trial. And their fates are even less clear if the prison actually was closed.
The fates of the people who will face trial also unclear, right? I mean, because they've been trying to get this trial underway for years, and it would be maybe an understatement to say that there's been stumbling blocks to making that happen. What is the status of the trial?
For sure. I mean, the military commission's process has been plagued with every sort of problem that you can imagine. They've had problems with the judges. They've had significant and lengthy disputes over what evidence is admissible in these judicial processes. There, of course, much of this is rooted in the torture that occurred that some of the defendants were subject to early on. You have had problems with access to the defendants on the part of their lawyers. There was unexplained bugging of some of the facilities. And just to give you an example, one of the most important trials that is part of the military commission process, the trial that the 9/11 suspects, has not even begun. And we're almost 20 years on from 9/11. And they are stuck in years of pretrial proceedings.
And that includes the trial for the most famous prisoner in Guantanamo Bay, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who is considered the mastermind of 9/11, allegedly.
That's right.
Okay, so whatever happens in this election is likely going to influence the future of this prison, the people inside it, and also the U.S. citizens who are working there. President Trump has promised to keep it open. Here he is at a rally as a candidate in 2016 during the Obama administration.
This morning I watched President Obama talking about Gitmo, right? Guantanamo Bay, which, by the way, we are keeping open, And we're going to load it up with some bad dudes, believe me. We're going to load it up.
Missy, the president has not filled that promise to fill it up with bad dudes, right?
No, he hasn't. And there was some talk when the counter-ISIS campaign was more active in Iraq and Syria about potentially bringing ISIS detainees to Guantanamo. But that never happened. And that's in large part because, as we were just discussing, the military commissions have been widely seen as an ineffective process. And the fact that the 9/11 trial has not begun is really evidence that they have not worked in the way that was envisioned early on. And the Defense Department does oppose bringing additional detainees to the prison. Another element that's important here is the cost of operating the prison. There was a study last year that put the annual cost of $13 million per year per detainee, which is far more expensive than any maximum security prison in the United States. And so it's costly, it's not particularly effective. And, you know, in the context of providing justice for the families of the victims of some of these terror attacks, it just hasn't worked.
Well, in fact, the president has criticized the amount of money that it takes to run the prison. He said he would reduce costs. But have there been any significant changes at Guantanamo Bay during his administration?
No. There was one detainee who was resettled overseas that was a product of something of a negotiation that occurred during the Obama administration. And unlike the Obama administration, where there were lots of detainees who were sent to other countries, it's basically been frozen since the day that President Trump took office. You know, it really has faded from the headlines, I think, because of the small number of detainees that remain and the fact that some of these counterinsurgent campaigns and wars that really dominated the American conversation in the years after 9/11 have faded to a large extent, but it's still there. And President Trump has not laid out a detailed plan for what he would do about Guantanamo if he does win a second term in office. But, you know, I think the expectation is that because there aren't any clear, easy answers, that it's very possible that it could just sort of continue on in this relative obscurity, the military commissions process, and then the fate of the other detainees who are not expected to be subject to trial.
Yeah, well, as we said, President Obama promised to close it, but failed. And Joe Biden was asked about that by moderator Yamiche Alcindor of PBS NewsHour during the Democratic primary debate last December. Let's listen.
Vice President Biden, why couldn't you close Guantanamo Bay? Why couldn't the Obama administration close Guantanamo Bay?
We attempted to close Guantanamo Bay, but you have to have congressional authority to do it. They've kept it open. And the fact is that we, in fact, think it's the greatest. It is an advertisement for creating terror.
Now, what was Joe Biden's role in the Obama administration's effort to close it?
Well, he was, you know, part of the team of national security advisors that was advising the president as he staked out, you know, his claim, as you remember, in his first day in office of closing Guantanamo. But it quickly encountered congressional opposition from people who didn't want to bring the people seen as the most dangerous terrorists to the United States for trial. And there was abiding congressional opposition of, you know, all the various tools and funding avenues that the Obama administration would need to empty the prison. And so they ended up at a certain point deciding to try to transfer prisoners overseas. And they did that with varying degrees of success. Sometimes it appears to have worked quite well. Other times some of the detainees had trouble adapting or were seen as creating problems of different kinds after their resettlement. So now Vice President Biden, as he's trying to make the case for being elected, he says that he wants to close the prison, but we don't know exactly what that would mean if he did win the presidency. It's unlikely that especially Republican members of Congress would be okay with bringing prisoners to their states. So my personal expectation is that the resettlement of the remaining detainees who are not subject to trial is the most likely scenario.
so Joe Biden might run up against the same problems that Barack Obama faced. Look, this was a big issue in past campaigns. The prison has fallen out of the news lately. Do you get the sense that whoever wins this election, you know, will either be unable or unwilling to close it down, and that one of the possible outcomes would be that it closes just sort of when time passes and the detainees become old men and die?
Yeah, I think that's a significant, there's a significant possibility that that could occur. It's this very tricky problem because of the unattractive nature of many of the potential options. And there's, you know, not really a constituency outside of some advocacy groups for these detainees. This, you know, very small number, we're talking about 20 detainees who are not subject to trial for what is going to happen to them. And it's really become sort of a political albatross, not just the forever detainees, but also the military commissions, because of the consensus that they haven't worked very well.
That's Missy Ryan. She covers the Pentagon and national security for The Washington Post. Thanks for taking a look at this with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
We've talked here about how the pandemic has upended the real estate market, people moving out of huge urban centers like New York, for instance. But in other cities, property values and home prices are still rising. In Atlanta, there's new development underway in longtime black neighborhoods that have been neglected by investors for years. But an investigation by member station WABE finds homeowners there face a new threat. Stephanie Stokes reports.
Sarah Mae Rogers says she built her house from the ground up. She bought the blue single-story home in South Atlanta from a nonprofit called Caris in the 1980s. And as part of the deal, her family took part in construction.
It was sad that me and my son had to come and help own the house until we got this house the way it's at now.
Rogers is proud of this home. She's lived in it for 30 years and paid off the mortgage. So it pains her to share how she nearly lost the place. It started because of concerns about money. Rogers is about 70 years old, and before she retired, worked mainly low-paying jobs. Meanwhile, her street's become a lot wealthier. She saw her property taxes double. That scared her.
I got to have money to pay the taxes, to pay the water and sewer, to pay this.
So Rogers decided to borrow money. She took out something called a title loan. These companies give you money and hold on to your car's title until you pay it back. But the amount you owe grows quickly, and soon the loan just made her problems worse.
I felt like I was just down in a hole.
This is when Rogers met a woman outside a gas station. Rogers had been crying. The woman was friendly, Rogers says, and offered help.
I thought that she was going to help me to save my car and to help me get my taxes in order. I don't know. I believed in her. I trusted her. I trusted her, and that was wrong.
Eventually, the woman came over to Rogers' house. She convinced Rogers to sign papers, papers that Rogers says she didn't understand. She only figured out later what they were, a contract to sell her home.
We're really seeing, you know, the dirty, evil underbelly of the real estate market.
Karen Brown is with a nonprofit called Atlanta Legal Aid. She's seen a rise in cases like Rogers in the last couple of years, and she has a name for them.
Home equity theft, because that's exactly what is going on. Investors, scammers are stealing the equity out of the home.
Equity is the profit owners could make from their home when they sell. And while homeowners all over Atlanta have equity, Brown says the cases she's handled are only in specific areas, gentrifying longtime black neighborhoods.
So as those homeowners in those neighborhoods have property values these days that are going up, they're targeted because they've got equity to steal.
Atlanta Legal Aid has handled a dozen or so cases of equity theft. Brown thinks there are many more they don't hear about, and our analysis shows she may be right. In gentrifying black neighborhoods in Atlanta, we found property selling for prices that were less than half the estimated fair market value, according to Zillow. And we found these at a higher rate in gentrifying neighborhoods. Imagine homes worth $100,000 selling for $50,000 instead.
That's a huge concern, because that means one of the benefits of homeownership is being stripped away.
This is Dan Immergluck.
I'm professor of urban studies at Georgia State University.
He says throughout history, black families haven't earned as much equity through home ownership. Banks have denied them mortgages or offered them terms set up to fail. Immergluck says in the U.S., home ownership is still the key way to build wealth.
And this equity stripping, you know, basically just destabilizes that process.
It's like as homeowners approach the finish line, predatory investors take their prize. And the homeowners who become victims of equity theft typically don't have other savings. This is Karen Brown again.
The one thing that those families may have that's of value is the home. And if it's being stolen from them, they're walking away with nothing.
In Sarah Mae Rogers' case, she signed a contract to sell her house for $150,000. Zillow estimated it was worth twice that. And Rogers says she didn't want to sell. In the end, she didn't have to. Atlanta Legal Aid challenged the sale in court. The woman Rogers met at a gas station said in court documents that she worked for an investor. She claimed Rogers knew she was selling her home. The woman didn't respond to our requests for an interview. Near the end of our conversation, I talked to Rogers about her plans for the house.
Well, when I got this home, it was our dream.
She says this home and all of the value it's accumulated over the years, it will be for her son, the person who built the house with her.
It makes me feel good to know, even though I don't know what he's going to do with it, it belongs to him. If I was to die right today, it'll belong to him.
She says he can sell it, but that will be his choice. For Here and Now, I'm Stephanie Stokes in Atlanta.
In this update, WABE's investigation on equity theft led to a response from the Atlanta City Council, which is now considering legislation to curb predatory investor tactics in that city. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.